From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. This week, as combat operations formally end in Iraq, the military is still trying to grapple with how to handle the so-called invisible wounds like PTSD and TBI. Also, the curious case of Benjamin Kyle, a man in his early 60s who remembers almost nothing about his life or who he was before 2004. Plus, how the band Arcade Fire made a music video about your childhood. It's pretty amazing. And the dean of jazz journalism, Nat Hentoff, on a life covering the likes of Dizzy Duke and Miles. That's on this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. One of the longest combat missions in American history ended this week. Operation Iraqi Freedom is over. But for many of the men and women coming back from their deployments, it's just the beginning. The beginning of discovering and then coming to grips with the mental anguish that sometimes afflicts those who've seen war. In a moment, we'll hear about how the military is dealing with it, but first to the story of one combat soldier who still struggles to leave Iraq behind.
My name is Specialist Coley Bazell. I was an infantryman in the United States Army, Striker Brigade, and was in Iraq late 2003 to 2004.
About a year after 9/11, Coley Bazell had been bouncing around odd jobs in San Francisco, but he didn't feel like his life was going anywhere, so he walked into a recruiting office and signed up.
I didn't know what I wanted to do or be, and our country was at war. You know, this was my chance to be a part of history.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
I remember being at the Chow Hall at Fort Lewis and paying attention to the news and seeing it. All they were showing was the invasion of the room, and I remember thinking, man, we need to hurry up and deploy over there, because if we don't do that soon, I'm going to miss out on the whole experience.
Coley got to Iraq in the fall of 2003. That was about 5 months after President Bush announced the end of the fight.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
Coley was 26 years old.
I remember just having this adrenaline in me. Like, I remember in the tent in Kuwait, talking to my friend Specialist Horrocks, telling him how excited I was and couldn't wait to cross the border into Iraq. You know, Horrocks has been in for a while, and I'll never forget. I remember he told me, he was like, be careful what you wish for, you just might get it.
Coley was sent to a base in Mosul. He saw plenty of combat, but also extended periods of boredom.
Up and down the same streets over and over and over again. Counter-mortar missions, patrols, ambushes, raids. You go up on a hill, you dismount, you sit there, you wait. Think of all the things you're going to do once you go back home.
And he did go back home. His tour wrapped up in 2004, and at first he was glad to be back, excited to return to civilian life, and counting down the days till his commitment to the Army would end.
But after a while, you're like, hey, wait a minute, you know, you realize you're viewing everything entirely different. You'll be at a bar or a restaurant, and out of nowhere, you'll just be like, whoa, you know, this war over there doesn't affect anything that goes on. You know, the war just seems invisible.
He got his discharge and started to get back into civilian life. That is, until early 2008, when a letter arrived in the mail.
Came in a manila envelope, opened it up, and it was my orders telling me to report back to Fort Benning 3 weeks from when it was sent. And it gave the purpose right there on the form. It said purpose, Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Back in 2004, when he returned from his first deployment, Coley started drinking heavily, and he started getting nightmares. And when he got that letter, he was sure he couldn't face going back. And so he went to a VA hospital to get evaluated by a psychiatrist. Coley suspected he was suffering from PTSD. The next day, the doctor handed him a letter to take to Fort Benning.
Mr. Bazell came into the evaluation visibly distressed, uncomfortable, presenting with flat. When asked about his experience in Iraq, he became more agitated. That one of the main incidents involved a firefight that lasted all day that took. During the course of talking about this incident, Mr. Bazell's speech became increasingly reported that he drinks heavily every day as a way to avoid these traumatic memories, usually to the point of blacking out so you can eventually fall asleep. He is severely isolated. spending most of his days in his room and sometimes going for several days to weeks without speaking to anyone.
Severe intrusive thoughts.
Upon returning from Iraq, Mr. Bazell and his wife divorced.
Irritability.
Hypervigilance.
Difficulty sleeping.
Feelings of depression and avoidance of people, places, and things that trigger him or remind him of his service in Iraq.
The Army determined Colby wasn't deployable. He never went back to Iraq, and 3 months ago, he quit drinking. He's still dealing with symptoms of PTSD, but he's trying to work through them by focusing on something else.
Now it's school. You know, instead of tuning out and numbing myself to the point of blacking out every night, absorbing myself in the books. You know?
I mean, have you gotten to the point now where you don't think about Iraq every day?
Well, I could sit here and say I try to, but that's impossible. Maybe not certain incidences, but just sort of this feeling that, yeah, I'm a veteran. I was over there. You know, it's just with me every day.
That's Colby Bazell. He spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco. He's written a book adapted from a blog he wrote during his tour. It's called My War, Killing Time in Iraq. Now, thousands of soldiers like Colby are diagnosed with PTSD, but there's also another disorder, traumatic brain injury, with similar symptoms. But TBI isn't a psychological condition, it's a physical one.
Fundamentally, PTSD is a disorder where you remember too much, whereas TBI is a disorder where you don't remember enough.
That's Dr. Gregory Oshanek. He's the National Medical Director for the Brain Injury Association of America. And he says many soldiers who actually suffer from TBI are diagnosed instead with PTSD.
Well, the main differences are that individuals with traumatic brain injuries also will have neurologic symptoms such as headache, light sensitivity, dizziness, and will have difficulty many times with balance. Whereas individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder will have more of the re-experiencing the symptoms, feeling ashamed, feeling guilty, avoidance types of behaviors, things of that nature.
I'm wondering, I mean, TBI presumably has been around since the invention of explosives. I mean, it's been a byproduct of war, but it's really something that we've only started to hear about with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Why is that?
Well, number one, you're correct. TBI has been around ever since individuals have learned how to hit their heads on things. But currently, the reason is that we are becoming more able to keep people alive that previously would have died from severe injuries.
What kinds of trends are you seeing among troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who are experiencing symptoms of PTSD or TBI?
One of the disturbing trends is still the sense of underdiagnosis, of looking at the PTSD as being the only disorder that exists. I'll give you a good example. With mild traumatic brain injury, one of the primary areas that's injured is with our frontal lobes. Our frontal lobes is what guides our behavior, what provides structure to our day. So when I get up in the morning, I've got to figure out what I'm going to eat, what I'm going to put on. I've got to figure out the route that I'm going to go to work. All of that is governed by frontal lobes. When you're in the military, these kinds of things are already determined for you. So you may have damage to your frontal lobes that are not manifest while you're in service, and then you go home to your community where you're asked and expected to be able to initiate these things yourself, and you have difficulty. So you end up having problems initiating, you look lazy, you may be seen as being anxious and depressed, you may start drinking because your relationships aren't going well. So many of these subtle kinds of changes really do represent damage to the starter part of our brain.
That's Dr. Gregory Oshanek. He's the National Medical Director for the Brain Injury Association of America. He joined us from the studios of member station WCVE in Richmond. Dr. Oshanek, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and T. Christian Miller of ProPublica have been investigating how the military treats soldiers with TBI. Danny's in the studio with me. And Danny, why do so many of these men and women go undiagnosed?
A number of reasons. One reason is that many commanders in the military still don't believe that traumatic brain injury is really
real.
Much of an injury. That's right. Another reason is that a lot of the doctors were never trained to diagnose traumatic brain injury. You know, and you know this guy from having reported on the military. A lot of the doctors who went to the war were pediatricians, or they were foot doctors, or they were family practitioners. You know, they saw the occasional concussion, but they didn't have any training in blast injuries.
Now, Danny, I know you've spent a lot of time with troops on bases. What kind of care do they receive when they get it?
I can't speak about all the bases, but we focused on one big base. It's the third biggest Army base in America, Fort Bliss in El Paso, mm-hmm. Texas. We found soldier after soldier after soldier after soldier who had come back with terrible cognitive problems, not getting good care. In fact, often getting blown off for months or years, even though they were complaining about their symptoms.
Hmm. It sounds so sobering, but I'm wondering if in any way, I mean, the military presumably was saying, look, you know, these are isolated cases. We are really on this. We understand it. We're getting this.
We have talked a few times with the vice chief of staff of the U.S. Army, Peter Corelli. And he has acknowledged that a lot of commanders still don't get it. I asked him recently, all right, if 10 is where you think the military needs to be in terms of understanding and treating traumatic brain injury, where do you think the Army is now? He said, I think we're at a 6, but we came from a 2
yeah.
or a 3, and I think we're edging towards 7, but still a long way to go.
Danny, something you've been working on with ProPublica, which will air next week on NPR, is whether soldiers who are suffering from TBI should get the Purple Heart.
Here's the most symbolic gesture that the military can do to say you have been wounded in action,
yeah.
give you the Purple Heart. And we found that soldiers across the country who we talked to who've been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, treated for TBI, are not getting the Purple Heart.
Are they eligible for it?
But
I mean, you don't have to draw blood to get the Purple Heart.
No, that's right. Oh, that's right. There's been a big debate in recent years over whether people with post-traumatic stress disorder should get their Purple
yeah.
Heart. Many people think they should. But the regulations have always excluded them. The regulations have always said, if you get diagnosed with a concussion, mild traumatic brain injury, then you do get the Purple Heart. But we're finding that's often not the case.
That's NPR's Daniel Zwirling. You can hear NPR and ProPublica's reporting on the Purple Heart and TBI controversy next week. Danny, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Gary.
Imagine having a whole life of experiences and then waking up one morning with almost no memory of it. It happened to a man named Benjamin, and his story begins near Savannah, Georgia.
I don't remember it. It was August 31st.
August 31st of 2004, Benjamin was found behind a Burger King in Richmond Hill, Georgia, near a dumpster.
Between 6 and 7 a.m.
Beaten and unconscious and thought dead.
Numerous red ant bites on his body.
Completely naked.
No clothes or identification.
And he was in a place that was very far off the road.
I don't actually remember too much about that morning. I don't know how I got there. In fact, I don't remember any of it.
Benjamin was taken to a nearby hospital. He had blinding cataracts in both eyes, possibly from sun damage. He was still unconscious.
They couldn't call me John Doe because they already had a John Doe. And then they said they were going to call me Burger King Doe because I was found behind the Burger King.
So he was BK Doe for a while, but eventually Benjamin woke up.
The ward clerks were literally screaming at me, telling me they had to have a last name to put down on their paperwork, that I had to give them a last name. So I just picked the only thing I could think of that began with a K was Kyle. So I just picked that for a last name.
It wasn't just that Benjamin didn't remember how he wound up behind the Burger King that morning. He didn't know how he wound up in Georgia or where he came from before that, or much of anything about who he was. He was bounced around between hospitals and eventually got a job at a homeless shelter where he'd stayed. A nurse there, Catherine Slater, was curious about him.
And the stories went around, you know, the gossip that this man has amnesia. And I was curious, I guess, because, I mean, how many people do you know that have amnesia? It was so unique.
After they became friends, Catherine found out that while Benjamin couldn't remember his past, he hadn't made much of an effort to find it. He couldn't remember his social security number. He couldn't get a job or a photo ID or even a library card.
I guess I just accepted the fact that that's the way it was going to be, and that's the way it was, so I just got on with it.
But Catherine soon learned there were certain specific things that Benjamin did remember.
Like when you have him look at the aerial photos of Denver, he knows about being in the library at the University of Colorado at Boulder, knew that they had certain trade magazines called Restaurant and Institutions. he knew, and his eyes light up and say, oh, that collection goes back to the 30s.
I remember I was born in August the 29th, 1948. And the reason I can remember that is because I was born 10 years before Michael Jackson on the same day. Michael Jackson was born August the 29th. I mean, that's why I think that's right, is because I just remember it that way.
He remembers other things, like watching a movie in Denver.
It was, Car Wash. Really stupid movie, but it was also very popular.
He remembers going to Catholic schools in Indianapolis.
You know, this is weird. The whole thing's weird, but I believe I was born in Indianapolis. I have a lot of memories of Indianapolis, but the memories I have of Indianapolis are nowhere near as vivid as what the memories are of Colorado. Now, I've talked to a psychiatrist, and they say it could very well just be a function of age, that when I lived in Indiana, I was a lot younger.
Most of his memories check out in one way or another. They're real places that can be dated and traced, but most of Benjamin's memory cuts out in the mid-1980s. So back in 2007, with Catherine's help, the FBI got involved.
My name is Bill Kirkconnell. I'm a special agent with the FBI stationed here in Savannah, Georgia.
And they ran Benjamin's fingerprints.
There's more than 60 million criminal fingerprints on file and more than 200 million civil prints on file. I thought there was an excellent chance that, you know, maybe Benjamin had a criminal history, but even if he did not, given his age, he might have served in the military or worked for the federal government. Unfortunately, those results came back negative.
Benjamin tried hypnosis, DNA tests. He's been covered by newspapers and television stations in most of the places he remembers, and even internationally. He's tried facial recognition software, missing persons networks, nothing.
After 6 years, all the obvious research or investigative things that can be done have been done. I don't think they're going to find it out that way. I think the only way they're going to discover it is if my memories come back myself.
If you have a family out there, because you might, how do you imagine them?
I don't think about it. I think eventually the memories will come back. At that point, I'm going to have to deal with it. I have kind of wondered how I'm going to integrate the memories that I've got now, because, of course, for the last 5, 6 years, I've created sort of a life that's bound to be totally different from what my memories will say it was when they come back. So,
what can't you do that you wish you could, besides, obviously, you know, getting a Social Security number?
Oh, well, I would love to get a driver's license. I've driven Catherine's truck around on private property, and I had no problems driving, which brings up something interesting, too. I keep wanting to dim the headlights by stomping on the floorboard. I guess they moved those switches off the floorboards quite a while ago, but it's on the stalk on the steering column now. Leastways, I'd love to be able to get a driver's license, just, you know, a driver's license.
Benjamin makes about $50 to $100 a month doing lawn and yard work, but otherwise Catherine Slater supports him. He says he knows some people think his story is a hoax, and even he admits it's hard to believe.
I never tell people when I first meet them. In fact, I never bring the subject up, because you bring it up to someone who you've never met before, they get this weird look on their face, and they kind of back away, like, what is this nutcase type thing. But after I meet people and talk to them, interacted with them for a while, it works out.
That's Benjamin Kyle. He spoke to us from his home outside Savannah, Georgia. You can see a picture of him at our website, npr.org. Benjamin, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We're hearing a track called We Used to Wait off the new album by the Montreal band Arcade Fire.
I used to write. I used to write letters. I used to sign my name.
It's about how life used to be before email, when you had to wait for things like a letter. But the video for the song is something out of the future. When you go to the video's website, you're asked to type in the address where you lived as a child. And soon, different windows pop up on your screen that show scenes from your old neighborhood, and then, eventually, the home where you grew up. It was done using new web technology called HTML5 and Google Maps, and since the video's release last Monday, more than 3 million people have tried it out. The Experiment is the brainchild of a video director named Chris Milk, who joins me from our studios at NPR West. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
So in a second, I want to try this myself, but I gather this is something that was only possible fairly recently?
There's a lot of technology going on. I mean, we're utilizing a multitude of different things in this piece, but the main thing that we're using is HTML5. HTML5 is a technology that people have been experimenting for a little while, but it's only been fairly recently that browsers have become HTML5 compliant.
So with this technology, I mean, it sort of opened up this whole world of what you could do with music videos. How did you think about working with Arcade Fire and doing this for one of their songs?
Well, I know Win Butler from Arcade Fire for a while now.
The lead singer, yeah.
And I knew this was something that Google had expressed to me that they were interested in being involved in. So I emailed Win, I think in January, and just said, I think this is something that we could work on together. And he started sending me rough mixes of tracks.
Well, I've got the website set up here on a computer in the studio, Chris, and I've got the address. The address is thewildernessdowntown.com. And it's asked me to type in the street address of where I lived as a child. And while I do that, I should mention that you can only use this right now with Google Chrome or Apple Safari, right?
It will work with the next version of Firefox, and Internet Explorer, I think, has a public beta coming out later this month. It's not a closed garden that we built. It's an open one, and it's just a matter of everyone updating their browsers to have the right technology to view it.
All right, so now I've got it set up. The video is playing. I typed in my street from Northridge, California. It's in the San Fernando Valley. I'm not going to mention the street, obviously. And there's my street. There's my house. I don't think I've seen it in probably 20 years. How do you do that?
We're pulling from Google Street View data and incorporating it into the piece, adding camera movement to it, color correcting it in real time.
I have to tell you, I'm a bit... emotional watching this. It's pretty powerful, you know, to see where you grew up with this song playing behind it. Is that why you ask for a childhood address rather than, you know, where I live now?
Yeah. Humans have this really funny thing, and for some reason, where we came from always seems to have more emotional weight than where we are.
Now, the sort of the main shot in this, aside from the images of your neighborhood, is this kid. Why do you have the kid running down the street, just sort of endlessly running down the street?
I mean, honestly, that kid for me is the teenage me running home from my girlfriend's house after we broke up. And then, I mean, to further illustrate sort of how crazy this thing has permeated out into the world, the girl whose house I was running home from way back then has contacted me because she saw the piece. I'm sure she doesn't know that she was the one who that guy is running home from.
Chris, you have directed videos for bands like U2 and Kanye West. I mean, sort of more traditional videos. Do you think that this is the future, that this sort of interaction with pop bands, rock bands, will be what you have created here?
You know, I don't know if it's necessarily the future of music videos. It's a future. It's not a television broadcast. It's not a projection on a cinema. It can change in real time. It can adapt. It's a really interesting new technology, and it's a really interesting tool to use as your canvas.
It's really amazing stuff. I don't want to give away other parts of the video because I think people should go on and try it themselves. The website is thewildernessdowntown.com. We've got a link up at npr.org. Chris Milk is the man behind it, and the song is called We Used to Wait by the band Arcade Fire. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks, Guy.
Nat Hentoff was 11 years old, strolling along a street in Boston, when he heard this through the open door of a record store.
And I just shout out aloud. It just reached inside me. Anyway, I rush into the store. What was that? Oh, it's Nightmare by Artie Shaw. That was his theme song then. And that made me realize that the only other music that had really hit me that hard was when I was even younger in an Orthodox synagogue and I heard the Cantor. And they used to improvise very passionately. Years later, I found out that Artie had based Nightmare on what was called a niggun, N-I-G-U-N. That was one of the melodies that the Cantor sang.
Nat Hentoff played the clarinet back then, but he knew he wasn't going to be the next Artie Shaw, so he joined the staff of the music magazine Downbeat as a columnist and eventually its New York editor. And from that perch, he witnessed many of the greatest moments in jazz history. Nat Hentoff's collected those stories in a new book. It's called At the Jazz Band Ball, 60 Years on the Jazz Scene. Just mention Dizzy Gillespie to him, and the memories come pouring out.
I've never known anybody like Dizzy who had such generosity of heart. The guys he used to play with used to call him the teacher. He would just make sure they knew what they were doing, and he helped them learn it. And he always was so generous. We got to be very good friends. And I hadn't seen him for some months, and he was rehearsing an all-star band to play at the United Nations. I came early to the studios, and I was standing outside where they were going to play, and Dizzy comes along on the corridor with a friend of his, and he sees me. We hadn't seen each other for a long time. He comes over and gives me a big bear hug. And then he said to his friend, "Gee, it's like seeing an old broad of yours you hadn't seen for a long time." Nobody gave me that kind of compliment.
What was the most memorable gig you ever attended? Who was playing, and what was it that you were hearing?
It was at Symphony Hall in Boston, where ordinarily the Boston Symphony Orchestra played. Duke Ellington, for the first time, went on the road with his full orchestra, playing what he had spent a lot of time about, although there was plenty of improvisation on it. It was called Black, Brown, and Beige. It was the history of black people in the United States from slavery to the present. And it was so extraordinary. At the end, people were so moved they could barely applaud until they got a standing ovation.
Lord, dear Lord of love, God Almighty, God above, please look down and see my people through.
And there was one other event that was very much like that, and it ties right in. I was, for a time, I reproduced records for a label called Candid. This was during the Civil Rights Movement, when kids, black kids in the South, would go into a restaurant, they were thrown out because they were sitting with us, weren't supposed to be sitting. Max Roach, the master drummer, wrote something called the Freedom Now Suite. And I asked Mac if we could record it. And in the studio was Abby Lincoln, Coleman Hawkins, Max, etc. And it was just like what I heard that time at Symphony Hall in Boston. The music just became part of you as you heard it. People began to have that same feeling about him that I had when I heard Duke Ellington playing Black, Brown, and Beige. You know, it's not a matter of white and black. It's, as Clark Terry once said, jazz is a gift. If you have the ears and you open yourself to the musicians, then you hear everything.
Now, in 1957, you helped put together this landmark program on CBS. It was called The Sound of Jazz. And I guess it was really the first time that mass audiences in America, especially mass white audiences, were introduced to jazz. What was it like for you to be part of that?
Well, I'll tell you something. When people sometimes, students sometimes say, "What's the most important thing you think you've ever written?" I said, "It's nothing I've written. It was a TV special on a Sunday afternoon on CBS called The Sound of Jazz." The producer was Robert Herridge, And he came to Whitney Balliot of The New Yorker and me and said, look, I want to have a pure jazz program. I don't care if the viewers know the names of these people. I want you to get together the best of all these players you know. And that's what we did.
Again, Studio 58 and the Sound of Jazz. Billie Holiday is one of a handful of really great jazz singers. Her blues are poetic, highly intense. Playing with her here today are some of the musicians who accompanied her back in the 30s and some of the greatest jazz records ever made. Billie Holiday.
My man don't love me. He treats me oh so mean.
Toward the end of the show, Billie came into the studio and she was surrounded by a small combo, including Lester Young. Billie and Lester had been very close, but they drifted apart. They were talking to each other in their music, and they were looking at each other in a way that made you feel that, well, like you were in something that was a very private space and time. And that section was so utterly moving that in the control room, all of us had tears in our eyes. So after the show was over, I went down to the studio, and Billie came running after me and gave me a big hug, biggest prize I ever got. And it was wonderful, the kind of reactions that the show gave from the audience. Robert Herridge got a letter a couple of days later from a woman saying, it's just wonderful to see people doing what they love to do. And that's their whole lives. You can tell it in what they're saying, in their music. And that's what this music called jazz is.
Love is like a faucet. It turns off and on. Sometimes when you think it's on, baby, it has turned off and gone.
That's the Dean of Jazz Journalism, Nat Hentoff. His new book is called At the Jazz Band Ball, 60 Years on the Jazz Scene. Nat Hentoff, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for swinging with me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend.